wondering if I should use this or not, because this is, we're not in committee technically, but I'm going to use it just to call people's attention, I guess. So we're going to call this meeting to order. And I hate to have the members so far away. I don't know if you want to move closer to us, but we have some other members who will be showing up, and I'm not sure. So hopefully we will have more members coming in. And it's wonderful to see you. I think we're getting incredibly busy really fast here, and it's been, I think, wonderful to hear the conversations that are taking place about education. So it's a good thing. So welcome, and we're going to have a conversation that was actually a conversation some members outside of this committee wanted to have, and we scheduled this, and hopefully they will be coming in, but we have a number of members in the Senate who have been paying attention to some of the reports that came out in the last few months about charter schools. And they thought this would be clearly an opportunity for us to really talk about, you know, future ideas as to, you know, where do we go from here? How do we expand the wonderful models that we have in the state of Minnesota? A lot of people are talking about how we have some amazing schools that people are talking about nationally, and we have not been able to kind of expand what they do, what we do, and replicate that. I see Senator Bonhoeff, who is not in my committee, but we would love to have you at the table, Senator, if you are willing to join us. We welcome your presence. So the idea was that, you know, a lot of people wanted to really look at how the schools that we have in place today that are working for our kids can be expanded, replicated, what are some of the barriers that exist. But we also wanted to talk about why is that we have the statistics that we have. As you know, we heard a few months back that 78% of kids who are attending charter schools are not performing at the level that we need to. So that was pretty alarming. And then in December, November, we heard that there is a significant growth on the number of parents who want to pursue charter schools. So we have this issue about, you know, performance versus what parents are looking for. There are some parents who really want to give. Obviously, all of us want to give an opportunity to our kids. And so where do we go from this place that we're at in Minnesota? So we thought this was a great opportunity to hear from the people who've been doing extensive research about all of these areas. And what I would like to encourage members to do is to please, we're going to ask questions at the end, whether they are related to the presentations or questions that you may have about other issues that your constituents have been talking to you about. So I think we should go around and introduce ourselves so you let people know who you represent today in the Senate. So Senator Dahl, if you would like to start.
Hi, Senator Kevin Dahl, District 20, Northfield. Good to be here today. Thanks.
I'm Senator Alice Johnson from District 37, which is out in Anoka County, Blaine, Spring Lake Park, and Coon Rapids, and I visited Centennial Schools and the Anoka-Hennepin School District this morning as Senator Weger had a tour out at Anoka-Hennepin. Good to be here.
Good afternoon. I'm Greg Clausen, and I serve the communities of Apple Valley, Rosemont, Northeast Lakeville, and Coates, District 57.
Hi, I'm Melissa Wickland, and I represent Bloomington and Richfield and Bloomington and Richfield school districts.
Good afternoon, Senator Terry Bonhoeff. I represent Northern Minnetonka, most of Plymouth, and the little city of Woodland.
Hi, I'm Susan Kent, and I represent Senate District 53, which is the city of Woodbury and parts of Maplewood and Oakdale and Landfall.
Good afternoon. I'm Carrie Root. I'm from Senate District 10. I have many districts and many schools because I have all of Crow Wing County and all of Aiken County.
Chuck Weger, District 43, which is all or parts of North St. Paul, Maplewood, Oakdale, White Bear, Mount Amite, Birchwood, and Willerney.
Thank you, Senators. So for the presenters, unfortunately, we have limited time, but I want you to know that we intend to come back and have a more in-depth conversation. There were many people who wanted to be here. Obviously, Mr. Orfield, who has done extensive amount of work, is not it's not fair to call you and say, please tell us in 5 minutes what you've done in a number of years. We understand that. And to obviously all the people who are presenting today who have spent years looking into this. But what we wanted was to give you just a very brief overview that could help us understand and the frame around charter schools, the information that is available to us. We can get more information later on, and then we will proceed to make a decision about when do we have another hearing, and we will go more in depth into some of that information and how that will be relevant to some of the proposals that will come out of the Senate. Senator Johnson, welcome. We are happy that you are here. Senator Carlson, welcome. If you would like to introduce yourselves before we start.
Dave Thompson, Senate District 58, which is Lakeville, Farmington, and a large chunk of Southern Dakota County down to the Rice County border.
And Jim Carlson, Senate District 51, which is Eagan and Burnsville, having school districts 191, 196, and 197.
Thank you, Senators. Mr. Orfield, if you could please join us and begin your presentation.
So I can manipulate the slides. Thank you, members of the committee, and I appreciate the opportunity to testify about the research that I and my team have done at the Institute on Metropolitan Opportunity at the University of Minnesota Law School. We've been studying charters for about 6 years, and I've done three comprehensive studies of charter performance versus public schools of similar characteristics. We are one of four major institutions that have studied the charters in Minnesota, the Brookings Institution, the Great Lakes Institute, and others, the Office for the Legislative Auditor, and all the conclusions have been similar. They've all been basically the same, that the charters have systematically underperformed public schools that have similar characteristics, similar types of students. So it's not just our studies. We have three reports on that, but also the Brookings Institution, the Office of the Legislative Auditor, and the Great Lakes Center, everyone that studied it, in fact. Charters have also contributed very much to the segregation of the public schools. The public schools have undergone a very rapid increase in racial segregation. In 1991, there were no racially segregated schools in the seven-county metropolitan area. Last year, there were 130. Charter schools are the only set of charter schools in the country that are exempted from civil rights laws. In all the other parts of the country, charter schools have at least some civil rights oversight. Charters in Minnesota are either very white or very non-white. There's very few integrated places. Mm-hmm. Charter schools often cause the public schools to compete toward both extremes. Single-race charter schools often cause public schools to open single-race public schools to compete for market share. Very white charter schools in racially diverse areas put great pressure on the public schools to create very white alternatives to maintain enrollment. So I'll talk a little bit about these findings, and then I'll be happy to answer some questions. The Twin Cities, as I said, has become rapidly segregated. I'm just going to quickly go through some of these slides because of the interest of time. This is a map that shows all of the public schools and the percentage of kids that are eligible for free and reduced lunch. The red schools are the highest poverty. The blue schools are the lowest. The reds are more than 80%. This is in 2009. You can see this is poverty. And this is the percentage change. You can see a lot of the increases in poverty are in the first and second and third ring suburbs. This is race. Race and poverty are tightly bound together. If you're poor and black and Latino in the Twin Cities, 3/4 of poor black and Latino kids go to schools that are more than 70% poor. 3/4 of poor white kids go to schools that are more than 70% middle class. So race and class are tightly confined. If you're poor and black and Latino, you go to overwhelmingly poor schools. If you're poor and white, well, this is changing a little bit. Poor white kids tend to go to middle-class schools in the suburbs for whatever reason. And the percentage change in diversity, the first and second and third-tier suburbs are undergoing a huge and rapid change in diversity. Minneapolis has been the place where Minneapolis and St. Paul have had the most charter schools. I'm going to show Minneapolis over the period in the last 10 years, and Minneapolis has moved from a fairly racially integrated system to quite segregated. The southwest part of Minneapolis has become white. The near south side has become Latino. The north side has become largely black in a few years. It's also lost a tremendous amount of enrollment. So this is a time series, and each of these schools is an elementary school. The pie chart show the racial composition. Blue is white, red is black, yellow is Hispanic, Latino, orange is Asian Pacific Islander, green is American Indian. And I'm going to show you a 10-year time series, and what you'll see is the schools south of the Lake Harriet will become mostly white. The schools in the middle of the city will become black and Latino, and then Latino, and the schools on the north side will become black. And the schools will, and in the very poorest neighborhoods, the schools will lose a lot of population. A lot of public schools will close. A lot of the kids have gone to charter schools. So this is the time series, and you can see over time how things are changing. The schools south of the lake becoming whiter, the near south becoming Latino. You can see the schools disappearing. Very rapid loss in Minneapolis. And one of the things I'm going to talk about briefly is there's no question that Minneapolis at the beginning of the period when charter schools were being created was not doing a good job with low-income minority kids. They weren't performing well. It's a lot worse now. And Minneapolis is a much poorer and weaker system, having lost a huge percentage of enrollment to charter schools. Minneapolis is weaker. It's doing worse than it has done before. It's lost a lot of its revenue. Unquestionably, the charter schools every year have done worse than the public schools have. So you've had a kind of a race to the bottom in Minneapolis with no real improvement. And it's fairly clear. You can see the weakening of the Minneapolis system. Here's free lunch. As the schools south of the lakes became white, they lost their poor kids. As the schools in the middle of the city lost their white kids, they lost all their middle-class kids. Here's Minneapolis. So you can see the change. Testing, Minneapolis in the south and the whiter areas of the city, Lake Harriet, some borough schools have some of the highest test scores in the state. Kids going to the, moving through the Southwest High School to some of the best colleges in the country. On the other side of the city, you have some of the worst test scores in the state, with a lot of the kids going to prison, not going to college at all. It's two very different systems, Minneapolis. It has some of the highest performing schools and some of the lowest performing schools in the whole state, within just a few miles of each other. This is charters, and you can see the charter, the racial composition of the charters. And this is in 2004 and 2005, and you can see many of the schools are all black or all Latino. You can see in St. Paul there are very nearly all white ones right next to the all black ones in St. Paul. And as you watch the time series, this is 2004, this is 2007 to 8, you can see the growth. And you can see this is 2010 to 11. This is 2012 to 13. So you can see where the loss of kids in Minneapolis has gone to, the charter schools, and also leaving the city. But charters are a big part of it. Mm-hmm. Now, charters present a really interesting problem in terms of civil rights law. One of the clearest holdings of Brown versus Board of Education is if kids of different races lived on the same block, that it would be unconstitutional for them to go to different schools on the basis of race. That's a very clear principle of Brown. It gets harder as kids live in different neighborhoods and places. But in the charter system, you have kids of different races that live on the same block, and the white kids may go to an all-white charter, the black kids may go to an all-black charter, the Latino kids may go to an all-Latino charter, and the Hmong kids can go to an all-Hmong charter. And they say it's different. It's really different because it's about choice. And I think this gets you to some interesting questions. There was a case the Supreme Court decided in 1968 called Green versus New Kent County School Board. And in Virginia, Virginia tried to say we should desegregate our schools by freedom of choice. We should just allow it freedom of choice. And they said anybody can go anywhere they want to. And the white kids stayed in the white schools, and the black kids were afraid to go to the white schools. And the Supreme Court said that, you know, freedom of choice is not good enough. They said it places too great a burden on the non-white children and their families. It places too great a burden on those that have been historically discriminated against, said the Supreme Court. The burden of integration should not be on those that are discriminated against. It should be on the school district. Maybe whether green is good law or not, it's a good question to think about anymore. So you can take a look at the population. The growth of charters have been predominantly in the very non-white and the very white charters. I'm going to show you a picture of the growth of charters in the central cities. And the red charters are charters that, had they been subject to civil rights law, and again, Minnesota is the only state that doesn't subject charters to civil rights law in the country, these were schools that would be problematic in terms of our civil rights law. So the red schools, you can see, this is the period of growing. And you can see growing in the central cities. You can see the growth of charters as they grow mostly in the central cities, but now spread to the first-tier suburbs. Now, one of the other types of charters that we've identified are what we call the white flight charters. And these are very white charter schools that exist in racially diverse, mostly suburban neighborhoods, but some urban neighborhoods. And very frequently, when a school district is attempting to integrate its schools, for example, the Eden Prairie School District or the Hopkins School District or the Osseo School District, when they're trying to work on issues of racial integration, the Apple Valley School District, Apple Valley had done some efforts. Often when they're working on integration, an all-white charter school pops up or grows tremendously when the school district is working on integration. So Eden Prairie drew very controversially integrated boundaries, and they had a white charter school that grew dramatically. Osseo has struggled with issues of integration in its magnet schools, and whenever it tries to integrate the schools, it has a white charter that grows quite dramatically. The Apple Valley School District integrated one of its schools that had become non-white. A very white charter appeared right next door. And these also raise constitutional issues. There's a case called Griffin versus New Prince Edward Board of Education that the Supreme Court decided in 1964. And this was related to what was called at the time segregation academies. And Virginia did not wish to comply with the Brown decision and decided to defund its public schools and to give people vouchers and create all-white and all-black schools and provide people the resources to do that. The Supreme Court in Griffin said that was unconstitutional, that even though many of the school districts declared that this was a freedom of association, freedom of choice kind of an issue, everyone could choose where they wanted to go, the Supreme Court thought that this was an unconstitutional issue. And you can see these circled schools are what we call the white flight charter schools. They're schools, charter schools that are all white or very nearly all white in very racially diverse areas, most of which are working on issues of racial diversity. These are charters that have been closed for misappropriation of funds or for budgetary issues. There's been quite a number of these, about 25 that we could identify from school district or school Minneapolis Star Tribune Pioneer Press articles. Here's a regression analysis of charter school performance. And this is a line that shows on one end you have poverty, and then the bottom axis is the percentage of children eligible for free and reduced lunch. And the other axis is the percentage of children proficient in math. And you can see as you get to 0% poverty, you have pretty high test scores. And as you move to 100% poverty, the test scores go down. The blue diamonds are public schools. The red squares are charters. And the line that goes through all of those is the predicted performance. And what this shows is that most charters underperform the public schools and the predicted performance. Now, there are some good ones. There are charters that do a lot better, but they're a small percentage of the total charters. Most of them are sub-performers, and there are many more very low-performing charters than there are high-performing ones. So this is reading, and this is math. Our results are consistent with all of the other published and peer-reviewed studies. So we've done that. We have three data points and three studies, one of which has been peer-reviewed and published in a peer-reviewed journal. The other two are awaiting publication. But all the other studies have found the same thing. So we're not finding anything new. We're just confirming all the other studies that charters systematically underperform public schools of similar characteristics. Now, you can see on this map, these are charter poverty and reading, and you can see elementary schools, and you can see there are 4,230 kids in 2012 and 13 in charter schools that are outperforming the public schools above the line. But you can see there are 6,181 students in those high poverty schools that are in charter schools that are underperforming the public schools. So you have some that are better, and you have a lot that are worse. At the other end, you see on the high end, in zero poverty, you have 1,596 students in very low poverty charter schools that outperform the public schools, but you have 3,159 in low poverty charter schools that underperform the public schools. And it's very important to look at the whole picture. I think the charter schools, they don't produce research that establishes their benefits. They issue press releases, and they often issue press releases about the very high-performing schools. And there are some high-performing schools, but there are many, many, many more low-performing schools. This is math. So policy recommendations. I think Minnesota should follow all the other states in the country and subject charter schools to the same civil rights laws that public schools are. Places like South Carolina and North Carolina, I think, have really good laws that we should adopt. I think if South Carolina and North Carolina can have civil rights laws that apply to charter schools, Minnesota ought to be able to have the same thing, too. And we should make sure that public schools should be monitored, ensure that charters don't facilitate white flight from diverse traditional schools. Yet another Supreme Court case, Wright versus City of Emporia, says that you cannot create new schools that interfere with existing integration plans. The Supreme Court in 1976 said that. So if a school like Eden Prairie or Apple Valley or Hopkins is working on integrating their schools, you can't have a charter school that interferes with that plan. They have to be working with the school district. That's a commonly enforced law in many parts of the country. So I think that's an issue. We should develop procedures to monitor charters and look at abrupt changes in performance. One of the things we found in our research is that many places in the country show charters suddenly showing 20, 30, 40-point gains in a short period of time, 2 or 3 years. More often than not, those kinds of gains have been false, and they have been related to cheating. And it's very important that we monitor the schools that are doing those having those gains to making sure that those aren't occurring. And I'd be happy to provide the committee with the dozens of places in the country where I found stories about these things happening. Many states monitor very sharp changes in test scores, whether they be public or charter schools. And I think it's very important because there's a strong tendency, we know, when we have these high-stakes tests, to make sure that that people are abiding by the test rules and that aren't inflating their statistics. And we should make sure, we should be very clear, if we're putting such high weight on these tests, that the tests are being administered fairly. We should be very careful to make sure that charters are not improperly shaping the characteristics of their student populations with requirements for parental involvement, targeted recruitment practices, specialized curricular procedures, disciplinary procedures, or other means. Many parts of the country have found that screening tools have, charters have effectively used screening tools to cream kids out of the system. And if you can reject all the kids that are having educational problems that are coming into a school system, you can report very large gains. And the charter law in Minnesota says that charter schools can't discriminate, but we have no mechanisms to see whether they're doing that or not. And in many other states, particularly California, where extensive studies have been done, a lot of the high-performing charter schools have been very successful at creaming out the kids that are educationally underperforming. So we should make sure that if we are rewarding this kind of, these kinds of test scores, we should make sure that they're not based on cheating and that they're not based on screening. We should develop mechanisms to ensure that charters with consistently poor student performance are closed. And we have not been very successful at doing that over time. We should develop mechanisms to monitor charter schools' financial practices and make sure that poorly run charter schools are closed. As I said, doing a survey of the newspapers, we found about 25 charter schools that were closed for mismanagement or misappropriation. I think these are important public policy tools, and we should be making sure that the charters are being well managed and taken care of. So I probably talk it longer than I should.
No, thank you. Thank you very much. You know, one thing, members, that I have to share with you is that this summer, this time after session has really opened my eyes to the incredible institutions that we have in place and how amazing our University of Minnesota and the institutes and people like you actually are. And it is interesting that in my perception, after being 7 years in the education committee, we are not asking for information from you as much as we should. So I am incredibly appreciative of the research that is behind this, and I wish we had more time, but we will. I think the information that is coming out of the School of Agriculture, the Institute on Race and Poverty, the Metropolitan Opportunity Institute is incredibly compelling, and thank you for doing this. We're going to have questions. Members, I wanted to make sure that I give you an entire picture before we go into questions, because sometimes we don't give time to the next presenter, and they are here eager to present the information. So thank you for your testimony, and we will come back with questions. But for now, we're going to move to the next presenter. Before we do that, we have a couple of members who have joined the table, and I would like to ask Senator Nelson and Senator Franson to please introduce yourselves.
Well, good afternoon. I'm Carla Nelson. I live in Rochester. I represent the cities of Rochester, Chatfield, Dover, Yoda, and Stuartville, and about 14 of the 18 townships in Olmsted County. I'm a former teacher, special education teacher, Title I teacher, reading specialist, and daughter of a principal. So I'm a PK as well.
Good afternoon. My name is Melissa Franzen. I represent Senate District 49, which encompasses all of Edina, West Bloomington, and then portions of Eden Prairie, Minnetonka. I'm an attorney by trade, full-time at Target. As of Friday, I'm now a leave of absence and here to serve. So excited to be back in session working on these important issues and very interested in what the work we're going to be carrying out in Achievement Gap and in other areas of interest in education. So thank you.
Thank you. Welcome, Senators. Then we have the department, Mr. Kevin McHenry, who is here to speak on behalf of the department and very relevant, obviously, presentation to the presentation that we just heard, because I think that we've been working on trying to respond to some of these trends that we see right now in research. You know, what is working, what is not working, how can we strengthen the ability of our different systems to do what they do best, and how do we replicate, you know, the programs that are working, and how do we support the programs that are not working. So thank you for being here, and please proceed.
Thank you, Madam Chair. First of all, Kevin McHenry, I'm Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Education, Charter Schools. The Charter Schools Division is one of the divisions that I work with. With me, I have Cindy Murphy, who's our Director of our Charter Center. Just a couple of things I did want to point out. I appreciate you holding the hearing. This is a really important topic, and I appreciate some of the information that's already been put on the table by Mr. Orfield. A few things that we're going to talk about here that we've been asked to talk about were what we're doing, obviously, in the department. We're going to focus on our work on our authorizer evaluation. Our goal with that is to put together a clear, transparent process of how our authorizers are performing, which will show, in the end, how our charter schools are performing academically, but also how they're performing financially, how they're performing administratively. And it'll be a clear, fair process, and Cindy's going to get into some details on that. We're also going to discuss our federal grant for high-quality charter schools. What we're doing with this grant is we're identifying high-performing, high-quality charter schools. We're also trying to incent them with some incentive funds from the grant, as well as be able to provide them with some replication money. Now, both of these processes, through our authorizer evaluation, as well as this high-quality charter school grant, we're doing our best to get as much input from stakeholders as possible. We'll have some dates lined out here as far as when we're hoping to get some input from you all as well. But I just want to make sure that you all know, as when we're putting a proposal together, we're putting together these two issues, that there's going to be differences of opinion, and we're trying to manage to put together the best authorizer evaluation and a best process for this high-quality charter school grant. And in the end, we do have some high-level academic data that we were going to share. But in interest of time, what we've done, I'm going to have Cindy give a high-level overview, and then we have some documentation that will give you more specifics, our rubric of where we're at in our draft form for our authorizer evaluation, and then some specifics of where we are at in our high-quality charter school grant. Thank you.
Madam Chair, committee members, thank you very much for this opportunity to share our work with you. My name is Cindy Murphy, and I'm the Charter Center Director at the Minnesota Department of Education. As Kevin mentioned, we're going to highlight a couple key initiatives of the Charter Center, but I thought I'd begin with just a quick slide to help lay the groundwork on the charter landscape in Minnesota since that landmark legislative change in 2009. So before the law was changed, we had 55 organizations that were sponsoring charter schools. And at that point, we also had about 153 charter LEAs or charter schools. Some of them may have had more than one site, but we are at 153. And also at that time, there were about 33,000 students that were attending Minnesota's charter schools. So where are we now? As you know, we have moved through a very rigorous process to approve organizations to be authorizers, and we currently have 26 active approved authorizers. As you can see in the slide and behind me, four of which are single-purpose authorizers, five are school districts, seven are higher education institutions, and 10 of our authorizers are charitable nonprofit organizations. We currently have 150 charter LEAs that are operating in the state, and they are serving about 45,000 K-12 students. We've also had 23 new charter schools open since the law changed, and so while the rate of growth of the number of new charters is not necessarily as high as it was before the law change, as you can see, we're serving 45,000 more students, which is a dramatic increase from 2009. Another fact of since the law has changed is that 26 charter LEAs have closed, some of which closed because their board decided to. Others may have been closed for authorizer oversight or a decision made that the school was no longer financially viable or was not meeting the terms of the contract. So we definitely have had a changing landscape since the law changed in 2009. The first initiative we'd like to provide you an update on is our authorizer evaluation system. When the law changed in 2009, the department was charged with not only approving organizations to be charter school authorizers, but also to evaluate their performance and issue a report on the authorizer performance at least every 5 years. We've been very active over the last year to develop that system whereby we will look at several measures of authorizer performance to determine if they are implementing statute as designed, as well as if they are implementing practices of effective authorizing. We are fortunate in that we've received a couple grants from the National Association of Charter School Authorizers that have enabled us to have additional resources to be really strategic and thoughtful as we've worked to develop this system based on national models, best practices in other states, as well as with input from our authorizer community in Minnesota. As you can see, some of the influencing factors, purpose, and philosophy of the system is that first and foremost, it implements the statutory requirements. We've also been very intentional and committed to involving our approved authorizers in helping to inform and develop the system with us at the department. There is an element of school performance that is factored into the system that we're developing, as well as alignment with national principles and standards for high-quality authorizing. And finally, an aspect of the system that is truly unique to Minnesota is that we're very committed to continuous improvement. We're looking not just to evaluate authorizers at a point in time and determine if they're sufficiently satisfying statute, but really at developing a system that encourages them to reach toward higher standards and best practices of performance. And so throughout the system, whether it's in the measures that we're establishing or the way that we're evaluating an authorizer, really looking to ratchet up the overall effectiveness and performance of authorizers in the state. As you can see on the next slide, there are several factors that are impacting the system. We have the statutory requirements. We also have other priorities that we've established at the department, access principles and standards that I alluded to, as well as input from authorizers throughout the process. We began to engage with authorizers intentionally last spring. We've had a series of meetings and focus groups to really find out what is of key interest and importance to them. So we're looking to really weave that and reflect that in the system as it develops. And then finally, as you'll see in the far right column, is the aspects of our system. We'll be evaluating authorizers on their capacity and infrastructure, on their processes and how they go about making high-stakes decisions to charter a new school or to renew or terminate a charter school. We will be looking at academic portfolio performance and financial portfolio performance of the authorizer schools, and that will inform how they're evaluated in the measures. And then we also have a process where they'll be re-upping and submitting a renewal application that will solidify their plans for the next 5 years as for their next phase of an approved authorizer. This slide is offered to show you that authorizer evaluation is really one piece of a comprehensive system of how the Department of Education engages with, oversees, evaluates, as well as supports authorizers. And starting with the first square, all of our authorizers had to have an application that was approved in order to charter new schools. We've been working with those authorizers for the past 3 years to review their requests to charter new schools, to expand schools in their portfolio, to take on transfer schools from another authorizer, as well as through their contract renewals. We've been providing need-based, technical assistance. As we've been working with authorizers that have been very active in chartering, we have been working to provide technical assistance and guidance throughout the year on an ongoing basis. As passed in the 2013 legislative session, charter authorizers will now be submitting an annual report to the department, and so that is being intentionally woven in to our process to evaluate authorizers. Our first authorizers are due for evaluation in the spring of 2015, so that's E. And then out of that system, we're really excited about the data that we'll have available to identify which authorizers are implementing especially effective and promising practices. And we plan to very intentionally identify and hopefully disseminate those practices to other authorizers. And then the system will also help us to better understand training needs of authorizers so that we can, not just in a technical assistance response manner, but really have training that we develop to, again, promote those highly effective practices of authorizing. This slide shows some key data sources. We'll be using the approved authorizer application, their annual report, and data we have at MDE, including MDE's data center that has a rich source of school-level data, and the authorizer renewal application that they'll submit. One of the aspects of the system that we're working on is the so what question. So we arrive at year five and an authorizer is due for their evaluation report. And how do we see that wrapping up or what might the consequences and rewards of that be? And so we're really looking that if an authorizer has a very high rating, if you will, of their performance level is well developed, that automatic renewal, we expect that they'll continue to be an authorizer for the next 5 years. They'll merely submit their renewal practices and plans, so we'll have it on file for their next term, as well as providing an expedited review of an approval of requests they might submit, such as new school affidavits and supplemental affidavits. If an authorizer receives a rating of well-developed, they will be invited to go ahead and move into the renewal application phase, as well as with a satisfactory rating. However, with satisfactory, there may be one or more areas that the authorizer is asked to address for continuous improvement, and that would be factored into their renewal application. And then finally, if an authorizer receives a rating of approaching satisfactory or unsatisfactory, we're really looking to spend some dedicated time with that authorizer to ensure that measures that are not at the satisfactory rating are addressed before they move on and intending to move into that renewal phase. And so we're also at this time proposing that they may be taking one or more corrective action steps, as well as they wouldn't be able to submit affidavits for new schools or expansions. Essentially, they wouldn't be able to grow their portfolio of schools until they had sufficiently addressed the areas or area that was behind that unsatisfactory rating. So as you can imagine, we've been very busy on this process. We're very much in the heart of it right now. We have several key benchmarks approaching over the next few months that you can see on the slide behind me, including having the evaluative rubrics done by the end of this month and looking to finalize the authorizer annual report instructions in the month of March, looking to push out the first portfolio data presentation in April, and then really having the full system that we're working on finalized, at least the outline of the system finalized, by the end of the fiscal year. In November will be the first submission by authorizers of their annual report data to the department, and at that point in time, we're basically planning to have the tools and the processes we need to engage in the actual evaluation completed. So in December, we'll be meeting with that first cohort of authorizers, and there are five authorizers in cohort one, and then we'll engage with them beginning in January through the evaluation activities. Okay. So we have four cohorts of approved authorizers in Minnesota, and as we develop the system, each of those cohorts will receive kind of a calendar of how we'll be working with them specific to when they were approved to authorize charter schools. The second initiative that we'd like to provide a brief update with you is regarding the High Quality Charter School Initiative that is funded under our Federal Charter School Program Grant Project. We have been funded for a five-year grant program. I spoke with you in the last session about that. And a key initiative under that grant program is really work to intentionally create and expand high-quality, high-performing charter schools. And so we have established an interim definition that provides us with our initial list of charter schools that are eligible to apply for a replication or expansion grant under the federal CSP grant project. Our first list, based on 2013 data, has 24 top-performing charter schools that have been identified. That definition is based on the most recent 3 years of data. We looked at both proficiency and growth data based on standardized state tests, and those two domains were equally weighted unless it was a high school. So if it was a high school, the graduation rate was also factored in. Additionally, in order to help ensure that the charter school was generally reflective of the communities being served in the area of the charter school, we calculated a demographic review, and we looked at specifically non-white student populations and students qualifying for free and reduced price lunch, and we verified to ensure that that rate, that demographic percentage, was not significantly different than the traditional school district in which the charter school was located. We have a list of the 24 charter schools and a handout to give you a little bit later, as well as the method and process that we use to calculate that. This is an interim definition, and it's related to a second objective under the grant. We'll be working to establish a more comprehensive performance framework that will move beyond state performance measures and include additional measures over time that will factor into our definition of high-quality charter school for the federal grant project. This funding opportunity provides a charter school with funding to expand beyond the scope or the number of sites or the grades served in the original charter school application, affidavit, and contract. Grants are available for up to 3 years and could provide as much as $225,000 a year to fund that expansion. We have our first opportunity for funding under this initiative this spring. And we're hoping to post the grant opportunity, the request for proposals, in March. And if all goes well, those grants will be awarded beginning in July. In addition to funding these fairly large grants, we also will be inviting the eligible schools to submit one or more best practices that they would like to have recognized and showcased. And so we've also set aside some funds to do mini grants. We don't have the exact amount set at this point in time. And that will allow us to provide some funds to schools to help them to disseminate their best practices, whether that be to other charter schools in the state or to other public schools, traditional as well as charter schools. And again, this opportunity is specifically related to the federal grant project, and we are slated to be funded in our five-year project through 2017. Okay. And again, we do have some handouts to help you better understand these initiatives. The last couple slides, we have pulled together just a couple data points that we were asked to share with you. I think it's important to note that what we're sharing here says as much, if not more, that additional data is necessary. But in order to give you just a very quick snapshot of charter school performance in a couple areas. So the first slide merely shows that the proficiency rate, so it's a very simple, high-level depiction of charter school performance in blue, as well as the state average, including charters, in orange. Okay. Now, as you can see, there is a difference. However, it's very consistent. And so this data in no way suggests that charter school performance has been worse than the state average since 2010. So a simple depiction there. If you open that up a little bit on the next slide, this is charter performance by ethnic subgroups. These are groups that are defined under the Elementary and Secondary Education Act. And again, this shows how different subgroups have been performing in math proficiency since 2010. And the third slide shows other subgroups, including free and reduced price lunch, English language learners, as well as special education students. Okay. So again, you can see a very basic, quick snapshot of math proficiency by these subgroups since 2010. The last three slides are similar in nature. This gives you a glimpse into the four-year cohort graduation rate. We're using the four-year cohort rate here because that is the standard, the basic rate that we're using for federal accountability purposes. Again, you can see the charter average performance as well as the state total average, which includes charter schools. Unpacking that a little bit, this slide provides you with a quick glimpse at charter school performance data by ethnic subgroup. And then the last slide here has free and reduced price lunch, again, English language learner students and special education students, the other subgroups.
Thank you.
Okay, and I know we'll take questions later.
This was excellent, and we really appreciate your response and your ability to package something that is incredibly complicated in a very short presentation. I think this was very successful, so thank you for that. And we will come back with questions. I have a few. I'm sure the members have a few questions. So next in the agenda, we have Mr. Simmons. So, members, we for the next few items in the agenda, so we wanted to give you the statistical information and then requests from different members who really wanted us to talk specifically what does that mean, who's doing well and what are they doing. So the next presentations are really examples of what we're doing in Minnesota with populations, with students, and we are really thankful that you're here. Thank you for attending this presentation. Go ahead and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you very much, and thank you for inviting me to this hearing. My name is Tony Simmons, and I'm the executive director of the High School for Recording Arts. I also served as a part of a working group along with my colleague David Greenberg from Audubon Charter Authorizer. It's part of a working group of the National Association of Charter School Authorizers, in creating the report entitled Anecdotes Aren't Enough, an evidence-based approach to accountability for alternative charter schools. And I have a copy of that report, and I have enough for everyone on the committee.
Thank you.
I'm here to testify about a fairer, more appropriate accountability relationship between our Department of Education and authorizers that oversee charter schools that serve significant at-risk student populations. High School for Recording Arts is a public charter school that has been in existence since 1998. Our original charter and mission is to work with young people who have dropped out or been expelled from school and to re-engage them through the exploration and operation of the music industry. We are probably unique in that serving this population is actually within our charter. And to this date, we probably serve one of the most at-risk high school populations in the state. To date, over 70% of our students at the time of their enrollment at our school have missed more than 6 months of school. That's considered to be amongst the most severe of class of dropouts. Additionally, more than half of our students live on their own, over 40% are homeless, and nearly 70% are involved in the criminal justice system. Despite these challenges, our school has continued to outperform schools in the nation that serve this population. We also have had 100% of our students receive a college acceptance letter, and our school has won national honors such as the North American Championship for Junior Achievements Company of the Year contest, where schools across the United States and Canada compete for best entrepreneurial ideas and operations. I offer all of these facts because as our school works within the accountability systems set up within the charter sector, where we are held accountable for our operations and student achievement, we must make sure that our Department of Education and our authorizer are working together to not only hold us accountable, but to also use the best in research and experience here and at home and from across the country in evaluating charter schools like ours that serve severely at-risk student populations. Consider the at-risk factors listed in the graduation incentives criteria that are used to determine eligibility for attendance at public alternative programs in Minnesota. If one variable were assigned for each of the risk factors listed in state statute, as well as additional variables for factors typical in urban alternative schools, like being formally involved in the criminal justice system, having addicted parents, having one or both parents in prison, or being involved in gang activity, one can see that the number of variables affecting the student's ability to succeed in school would be great. Students whose life circumstances and or behavior is too erratic to fit in the traditional system often end up in smaller experimental programs. According to the National At-Risk Education Network, students are placed at risk when they experience a significant mismatch between their circumstances and needs, and the capacity or willingness of the school to accept, accommodate, and respond to them in a manner that supports and enables their maximum social, emotional, and intellectual growth and development. One could also see that a large traditional school could become a mismatch for that student in that the institution's fixed nature, which may not pose a problem for the majority of its students, becomes untenable for the student experiencing at-risk factors. Schools like ours are being held accountable for factors that are largely beyond our control: incarceration, family crises, homelessness, transience, pregnancy, mental illness, and chemical dependency. We are aggressive in helping students to overcome all of these kinds of obstacles. Yet it is impossible for anyone to completely eliminate them. The current assessment tools are a more significant measure of who walks in our door than how we are doing with them. Common sense tells us that the input data is as important as the output data in evaluating the effectiveness of any system. The notion that one can attempt to quantify an individual person's instability or level of risk is not new. Public health researchers and policymakers have used risk stratification data for years as a tool for creating more effective and timely interventions in patients with certain illnesses and disabilities. This risk stratification type of thinking needs to extend to the network of dropout recovery charter schools and their authorizers. Any evaluative system that is a mismatch for the school will also be a mismatch for the authorizer, in that the relationship between the two needs to be constructed in a manner that encourages mutual success, fair accountability, and appropriate measurements and interventions. How can this success exist if the basis for the relationship, accountability based on measurement, is faulty, inappropriate, and does not take the high number of variables into account? Furthermore, the nature of high variability programs means that no two will be the same, and their student populations can look considerably different across the state. Therefore, an accountability system in which each category has a menu of accountability goals that could be mutually agreed upon by both the school and its authorizer would guarantee that the most intelligent decisions could be made to ensure the goals and measurements that would be best suited for each program. One should not separate creating a system for analyzing authorizers from analyzing their schools, as it is putting the cart before the horse. It is also valuable to measure not just the student data, but the program's success response to the patterns of variables that the students bring to the school. For example, if a school sees a pattern of increased homelessness, do they make appropriate staffing, resource, programming decisions to meet this challenge? Is the school an agile organization that uses feedback loops in decision making? It is important that high variability schools have this pattern of thought and action, and this should be part of the school's assessment. Despite the complex, difficult nature of creating accountability plans for alternative charter schools, California, Colorado, Oklahoma, Florida, and North Carolina have fully implemented alternative accountability plans, and other states are considering or are in the process of doing the same. Furthermore, the U.S. Department of Education has states the flexibility to exempt schools that serve dropout populations from uniform accountability measurement programs. We feel that Minnesota should be among the first to realize the untenable situation created When uniform accountability standards are imposed on all schools, regardless of the nature of the school's populations. We do not feel that things like homelessness, dropout status, living without a parent are excuses. We do, however, insist, and research backs this up, that they are factors. Ignoring these factors would be detrimental to the future of Minnesota. Lives will be wasted if charter schools that serve at-risk students in innovative ways are shuttered due to inappropriate accountability measures. One must consider actual lives lost, an increase in incarceration of young people, an increase in dependence on government programs, as well as the overall economic impact. In The Economic Value of Opportunity Youth, authors Clive R. Belfield, Henry M. Levin, and Rachel Rosen relay important information after years of studying the economic impact of opportunity youth, which are defined as young people not engaged or minimally engaged in work and or school on our society. They calculate the immediate burden and the future burden of youth who are not engaged in education and or the labor market. Quote, we estimate that each opportunity youth imposes on average and compared to other youth an immediate taxpayer burden of $13,900 per year and an immediate social burden of $37,450 per year. That's in 2011 dollars. There are annual amounts for each year that a youth is identified as having opportunity youth status. After each opportunity youth reaches 25, he or she will subsequently impose a future lifetime taxpayer burden of $170,740 and a social burden of $529,030. These numbers are staggering. For each learner receiving a diploma from a school like High School for Recording Arts, the effects of the risk factors that may have put them in opportunity youth status will have been greatly mitigated. As referenced by the National Association of Charter School Authorizers, a leading charter school group in which I was a participant, quote, a conscientious authorizer doesn't accept excuses for poor performance from any charter school. And yet, these schools can make a compelling case that, quote, our kids are different, and that conventional accountability measures fail to tell the story without a clear understanding of what renewal will take, what evidence will count, and where the bar will be set. Minnesota must make sure that these measures are in place for alternative charter schools before attempting to assess and force punitive consequences on or by their authorizers. Otherwise, failure to act could result in unintended consequences that would deeply harm the state of Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you very much. We really appreciate that.
Madam Chair.
So might I just make one quick comment before Mr. Simmons leaves the table? I've just been sitting on my hands here to hear this, that a school that has 70% of its enrolled kids who are habitually truant, 70% in the criminal justice system, and 50% homeless, at graduation, 100% of them have received a letter of acceptance from a college. I think we should be clapping. That is just an amazing feat. And I just want to congratulate you, and I don't want to let that statistic go by without acknowledging its significance. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we do applaud. You know that I met Mr. Simmons a few years back when the school was going to be closed. And I'll tell you the story later, members, but we had some significant challenges with the federal legislation that came to really look at what the schools were doing, and they came and explained, you know, what was happening in the school, and it was, but we will talk about it. I just think that it has been wonderful to be able to see, you know, what the school is doing and this incredible work that you do for our kids. But we will get back to questions.
And I just want to add, there are other schools like ours doing the same kind of incredible work, and we really just want to make sure the system is fair with those schools that are serving this type of unique student population. Thank you.
Thank you. Let's see. Yes, Smith Baker. I don't know if she is here. Oh, yes. Thank you. Welcome to the committee.
Thank you very much. I apologize for not having copies in advance, but I will provide them. And I want to thank you, Chair, and the committee for an opportunity to testify here today. I have great timing in terms of following Mr. Simmons and the great work of High School Recording Arts. That's a school that has been written about in the Harvard Review. It's a school that's getting notice on a national level, yet locally we have had to fight to keep it open, which is a great misfortune and one that I hope that we soon correct. I am Shonda Smith-Baker. I'm the CEO and president of Pillsbury United Communities, which is a nonprofit that's been embedded in communities for 135 years. And so I'm quite thankful for the opportunity to present on the issue that's important to our community, that's important to our youth and families, and very personally important to myself. Leading this organization has been very exciting, and that our focus has always been on working with marginalized communities. That in our history, and we come from the settlement movement, it's always been about being settled in communities with groups of people that have been unable to navigate systems by themselves, and that we work with them to assist in understanding their issues and work with the systems translating on both sides. We have many examples throughout our history of being successful at this type of work. I want to just point out a couple because I think it's important for context. One program we have is a program we call our Full Cycle Bike Shop on 35th in Chicago that, in essence, is a homeless youth outreach program that takes an approach to reducing homelessness amongst young people by having them go to classes for 3 months and then run a bike shop for 3 months. So in essence, we have 6 months to learn them, to understand them, to get them connected to something that they can be successful in. And we are outpacing, in many instances, other more traditional approaches in connecting homeless youth back to school, back to resources, to employment. And most times than not, we become their letter of recommendation. We become their referral. We become their address, in order to allow them to see themselves differently and the systems in which they are involved in to see them differently. Other strategies include truancy reduction. We have partnerships with the county homeschool. I speak personally at Stadium View on a regular basis, working with young people when they come out of the juvenile detention centers to get them reconnected. We have college preparatory programs for students that are underachieving and don't see that in their future. We have been able to re-engage them, and currently right now we have 67 in college, in which we have provided over $600,000 in scholarship funds that we have personally raised and committed to towards their success. I say that because our approach to chartering is no different than our approach to all of our work. And I say this to say that in 135 years of working in community, in our time that we have seen working in community currently, we understand that there are students that are not being seen by the current system. When I look at the system now and I look at graduation rates, if I just point it to African-American boys, and those students in some cases are 37% in graduation rate, what I'd like to say is that Pillsbury United Communities works with the other 60-something percent that has fallen off of your grid, and you have no insight into where they are. That's what we do, and we do it well. And what we have decided and remained committed, besides and in spite of the criticisms, I would say, that we have taken as being perhaps deemed as not a quality authorizer because of the portfolio that we have had, I would say that we, too, deserve applause for taking on those schools that no one else likely would, those schools that are taking on those students that have fallen below that grid, that have fallen off of everybody's radar until they show up in one or two places, prison or grave. And that is not what we need for this state. Tony has outlined the cost to society, the cost to community, and what happens to families as a result of that. In our portfolio of schools, which includes 11, six of them are high school, which I think distinguishes us as an authorizer. Two of those schools offer K-12, or it's along the continuum of offerings that they provide. Within those schools, there are two that offer online education. Those schools have been accredited on a national level. They offer a range of opportunity. Many of you all probably know families of that have kids that are struggling with drug addiction or numerous things that have not allowed them to connect in traditional settings. You have seen personally, I assume, the great anxiety of those parents who are good parents but have struggled to find fit for those students. Those kids show up in online education. Those kids who have medical issues that are too severe to be in traditional settings, that's who we serve. The ones who have parents that are unable to provide for those kids, who need those kids to work, that's who we work with. Those kids that go to school online don't come in for testing at the same rate. They often are recovering credits, and the most amazing thing, I think, is that despite the number of circumstances, they have chosen to continue their education, juggle many balls in the air, and to seek a high school diploma. And I think we owe that to them, and not just our conversations, but we owe them a view in all of the accountability systems that we offer in this state. Our charter schools often have an overage student. High School Recording Arts is an example, and it's not unlike many of our schools where a freshman comes in at age 17. Simply by that, we do not qualify under the four-year graduation rate. It doesn't mean we're not graduating them. It means that it doesn't fit underneath the current definition of graduation rate. I just started on a roll here. Let's see. So let me just say that, and one of the other things that I'd like to say is that the students that I'm talking about are not just low-income kids of color. That's not who I'm talking about. They are included in that discussion, but that's not it. We're not talking about a single mom who's maybe under-resourced and stretched and maybe undereducated and needs some support. That's not who we're talking about. As a matter of fact, I used to be that mom living in North Minneapolis in 55411 who did not go traditionally to school, that came out of North High School, decided in 2000 that I was going to go back to school and reengage myself in getting my my degree. I came from a supportive family, but I needed some support. I got the support from community, from some of you in this room. And from 2000 to 2011, I got my BA, my master's, and became CEO of Pillsbury United Communities. That's not who I'm talking about, but I relate to who we're talking about. Who we're talking about are young people that are born to parents who are not taking care of them for various reasons. We're talking about kids that are gang involved. We're talking about kids that are coming from gang involved families, where it's not the kids in the street that are recruiting them, it's their parents that are recruiting them. That's who we're talking about. We're talking about kids that are in and out of prison from the time, or in and out of a correction system from the time they were five, getting kicked out of school, repeated suspensions, mental health issues, victims of violence, witnessing violence, sexually and mentally, emotionally abused. That's who we're talking about. That's who we focus on. And those are the schools in which we authorize. That's what we do.
Ms. Smith, I wanted to make sure that our staff related to you. We've been reviewing some statistics, and we've been kind of really trying to figure out, you know, what do we do with the policy that we have in place? Do we need to expand? Do we have what we need? Is this policy comprehensive? Do we really understand, you know, in practice, what is happening, what is working? Could you tell us very briefly we understand some of the demographics you're describing here, you know, the profile of the student you serve. Could you tell us a little bit about what are some of the practices that you find are most effective right now in the programs that you have? You know, what actually works that you see, you know, it's really an important practice, and this is how you will need help from us. What is there or is not there for you that we could say, you know, we need new legislation or new resources to continue to do. Could you describe that?
Yeah, so if I started on the last point in terms of what are the resources, these students need a special kind of wraparound service and connection to community. There are many things, and let me just say that I'm not talking about schools with a handful of kids like this. I'm talking with a population of 70% or more of students that are in this description that I'm laying out for you today. What we need is recognition that these students are different and those schools are different. What we need is a system that applauds these young people's ability to get reconnected towards their diploma, that somewhere in the conversation that's happening on a broad community view, that they can see themselves in what looks like a trajectory towards success, and right now they don't. They see themselves as doom or gloom. So there are many things that I think we could use in terms of not being held less accountable, but understanding what those accountabilities are. We need room to innovate. And let me tell you, every teacher that comes through the system is not equipped to deal with these students. Best practices for other students are not best practices for these students. You need folks that when a SWAT comes in to arrest one of your students because they were involved in something the night before, that there is a way of calming things down. When there's gang beef in community, you have people in the school that know that there's a gang beef going on so that we can work to get through that issue so that learning can continue. There are some really clear exceptions to how we approach this work that I think that the school leaders of the schools would probably be better equipped to deal with. But certainly there are many examples of this. I also want to say that in a traditional alternative learning setting, those schools are really about prevention of dropout. And so the distinction here is that we're recovering the dropout. And I think that's an important distinction that, and when we look at some of our data, where our kids are coming from, if they're not coming from the streets and we're not out there pounding pavement, because that's who we have, our staff within these schools that are working beyond those school days and hours out into the community, going to the jails and recruiting kids back into school. That takes a different type of leadership and expectation. So where I am now with this is that, and I can tell you that the majority of the kids, again, that we're not out knocking the pavement on are coming from traditional schools that are walking those kids in the door. And so I agree with Mr. Simmons is that we are taking on students that have had a whole path. You know, their path forward looks bleak, but I can tell you when you hear where they've been from, it's incredibly disturbing that they have been allowed to live through the multiple systems that we support in this state without having interventions at an earlier age. And I have told my staff and our schools that I'm on a mission to be able to explain who we are as an authorizer. And I open up any file we have, and I can prove to you that we follow every statute. We hold our schools accountable. And I can almost tell you, I mean, you know, I live in the community. I'm raising kids with friends. I see what happens. I run an organization in which we interact and serve 13,000 young people a year. That is significant. I know what happens to these young people. You cannot separate me and how I lead this organization from what I know happens in community. You wouldn't do it. I would never take on something I couldn't stand behind, and I mean that with all of my heart in terms of our authorizing practice. the schools that I have witnessed that I did not think brought that to the table, they no longer exist, and there are four of them that we have closed down. I invite anyone in this room and around the table to call, to challenge us, to come and visit these schools, to see what these amazing young people have done, to see these teachers who see the potential, to know how to uncover what these kids are capable of in ways that they hadn't even seen in their whole time from kindergarten or from birth until they arrive at age 17. It is remarkable work.
Thank you very much. We applaud the work that you're doing and are very proud of, obviously, what is happening, you know, with the organization. So we look forward to hear more about, you know, what is happening and how we can support your work. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next, we have Mr. Joe Nathan and Bill Wilson. And after Mr. Nathan and Mr. Wilson, we are going to open for questions. So I would like to encourage you to please. We are meeting only until 2:30, so we're going to have to speed up the process. We probably have to stay a few minutes. I hope that the members are willing to stay. Senator Nino, welcome. Sorry we couldn't stop the presentation. It was exciting to hear what Mrs. Smith wanted to present. Could you introduce yourself?
I'm State Senator Sean Nino. My apologies for being late. I have three concurrent meetings going on, so I'm trying to bounce around.
Thank you. Thank you for coming. Your computers.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity. I've spent 43 years as a public school teacher and administrator, PTA parent, member of the state PTA. I don't think I've heard more deceptive testimony than I heard earlier today. And I want to say that when I was working on a PhD, which I have earned, and when I was asked to work with governors throughout the United States, I learned how to present information in ways that was a little bit like the classic story in the statistics about how there was a newspaper in another a newspaper in Russia that said there were two cars running in a race. The Russian car ran first, and the Russian car ran second, and the American car was next to last. So let me give you a couple of quick examples, some testimony that you heard that had some questionable assertions before turning to my own. One, charter public schools do not have to follow civil rights laws. Wrong. That's easy to document. Charter schools have to follow federal civil rights laws. If the state decides to insist that the schools such as the one that Simmons represented or the one that Mr. Wilson, former commissioner of human rights, if they have to have a racially diverse group of body, then you will close down some of the state's most effective public schools. That's point number one. Point number two, we heard that there was a difference between public schools and charters. More than 20 years ago, the state decided that charters are public schools. Three, we heard that every finding of every study shows that charters are doing worse. That was later amended, every finding for every in the peer-reviewed journals. So I called up the legislative auditor of this state and their report in 2008, and I quote directly from the summary. I'm quoting directly. After accounting for relevant demographic factors and student mobility rates, the differences in student performances were minimal. It's not my language. That's a legislative auditor's. The differences were minimal.
Mr. Nathan, I would like to intervene here. You're engaging in a process that is not helpful to us in my view, and I have to say this because the statistical measures that you are utilizing in order to question Mr. Orfield's outcomes and presentation and it's basically something that we will have to engage in an academic class in here to really figure out what are the variables and why. So clearly the factors that we're trying to analyze here are race and poverty. clearly the factors around achievement gap tie to race and poverty. And that is the core element, because a lot of the kids in this state who are affluent and who are white are doing well. So the core question is, why do we have the gap that we have? So if you remove these factors, clearly what Mr. Orfield said basically becomes irrelevant. His analysis are around high concentration of race and poverty. So it's a different measure, and I just want to make clear that the members understand this. There's a significant difference. We're analyzing high incidence of race and poverty, high concentration in this, which we are the number one in this country. So based on that, his analysis is actually accurate and true. I hope we're understanding each other on this.
Well, I appreciate the chair's interest in focusing for many years on achievement gaps. So I want to turn to the work that we've done, which eliminated achievement gaps. Not reduced, eliminated. And I appreciate the work of Marissa Gustafson, who's going to assist in that. We've been asked by the largest foundation in the world to work with Cincinnati, where over a period of 7 years, we increased overall graduation rates and eliminated the graduation gaps with white and African American, between white and African American kids. Not by sending out thousands of youngsters to the suburbs, but by doing a series of things right in the city that eliminated the graduation gap between white and African American students. Secondly, we have worked with dual enrollment, which, as you know, you and others have been a strong advocate of, to increase the number of low-income youngsters and youngsters of color who are participating in these programs and producing dramatic gains. And we can talk more about that. We can talk more about the charters in the state that are producing significant gains and are enrolling, as Mr. Wilson will explain, a very high percentage of low-income kids. We could talk, but we won't, about the implication that some of these schools are cheating. I want to also direct your attention to the 2012 Beat the Odds list that's in the PowerPoint presentation that's been prepared. You'll see Harvest Prep, virtually all African-American, 81% low income, was rated by the Star Tribune. It may not pass the test of the River Journal, but the Star Tribune lists a number of charters, most of whom have high percentage of youngsters that are doing very well. And the Star Tribune didn't rate cheating. But I also want to direct your attention to the right-hand side of this, the Perpich Center of the Arts, which the Star Tribune rates low because those kids are not doing well in math. Mr. Simmons is absolutely right, that we have to have a searching discussion about a variety of ways of measuring youngsters in our state. And certainly graduation rates and certainly test scores are part of that, but it seems to me that we need to have a broader discussion. Recognizing that time is going on, I'm not going to go through the full PowerPoint, just make three last observations. First, we are not advocates of charter schools, and we are not advocates of district schools. We are advocates of excellent public education. We can, at other points and in the PowerPoint, describe some of the characteristics of outstanding schools. I would suggest that the High School for Recording Arts is a terrific school for a certain group of kids. And even though it appears on some lists as low performing, if you talk with the kids, who, by the way, go to school less than 10 minutes from this room, I think you would hear about how that school has transformed their lives. So I completely agree with the chair that it's important to look at what we can do to increase overall graduation rates. I think it's also important, as we consider this, to look at the outstanding record of historically black colleges and universities. As I've mentioned in the PowerPoint, 20% of the African-American college enrollment in the United States goes to historically black colleges like Howard and Fisk and so on, and yet 40%, according to the U.S. Civil Rights Commission, 40% of science and engineering degrees are held by African Americans. Almost half of U.S. African American public school teachers come from them. And HBCUs are 17 of the top 21 U.S. producers of African Americans with PhDs. I'm going to skip very quickly to the final recommendations that I'd make. First of all, you have demographics, but I'm going to skip to that because, in the interest of time, we have an example in here, YouTube video that youngsters created, which we're going to try to run 30 seconds of, and then I'll make three quick recommendations and be done. First, as you're pulling this up, It seems to me that one of the original ideas of charters was to bring together charters and district schools to learn from each other. So I'd suggest that the legislature consider providing some funds to the Minnesota Department of Education to bring together terrific district and charter schools to share best practices. There are some terrific district schools. I'd urge that the legislature consider that. Secondly, the teachers' unions in this state, in part as a response to the charter movement, have suggested site and self-governed schools. There are wonderful examples of this in Boston and in L.A. Unfortunately, this has not moved ahead very much. Part of the reason is that there aren't startup funds. I'd suggest that the legislature work with the teacher unions, the superintendents, the school boards to designate some funds that would be available to start within district options modeled on the Boston pilot schools. Finally, it seems to me that the legislature quite wisely 4 years ago said that you wanted to change the way that authorizers operate, and I think you were very wise in doing so. And so it seems to me that you ought to allow one cycle to see what actually happens with the reviewers before taking other precipitous action to, frankly, humiliate certain schools and certain authorizers. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Nathan, one thing that I would like to follow up on as we move forward, I know you've shared with me just outstanding information around kind of the support systems that need to exist for youth, which is what Ms. Smith-Baker was talking about, you know, that we have populations that we kind of look at the academic growth and what we need to focus on the academic measures and how important it has been to put kind of systems of support around and track how that is working, you know, consistency of mentoring, consistency of counseling, attendance, and all of these other factors that really contribute to kind of the growth and the achievement in kind of different measures. So I would love to follow up with you on that because I think you have some very good information that is very compelling. I know this is too fast, but I want to make sure that when we meet again, we touch on that because we need to see that that video that you wanted to present and make sure that we address that. So thank you. Please proceed.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Bill Wilson, Executive Director of High Ground Academy Charter School. I recognize our time is short, so I'll make an effort to abbreviate my comments. My written comments will be online at our website. I recognize I cannot complete them all today. I just want to make a couple of recommendations, Madam Chair, right off the bat. I commend this committee and the department in its efforts to work on closing the achievement gap. With that in mind, I want to call your attention to a recently published book, First in Class, which was published by Harvest Prep, where in fact they took this issue on and debunked the idea that race and poverty somehow controls educational outcomes. My school also, Higher Ground Academy, feels the same way, and I think our work and our effort shows that. But that, I think, is very important. If every member of the committee would get a copy of that book and please read it. It's a great read. It's a quick read, but it really gets at the heart of what's going on with respect to the issues of race and poverty. Children cannot control the circumstances in which they come to this life. But through education, they can control where they go. Much of this discussion, early discussion, I'm not here to criticize, but I'm also here to say that most of our discussion has to have to be about education, not segregation. The United States Supreme Court resolved the question of school segregation in 1954, at a time when I was a student in school, in public schools in southern Indiana. Part of my experience as a student, as a child, was to attend segregated schools because the Supreme Court had not made that definitive decision. I would ride past three or four white schools, all white schools, to get to the school that I was directed, the all-black school. That was segregation. Segregation not only in education, but in jobs, in housing, in public accommodation. Laws have addressed that and make very clear what needs to be done to redress or address those issues. I don't think we need to rehash the question of segregation and confuse it with choice. These are two separate things. I'd really appreciate if we could focus on that. Now, the state of Minnesota decided that choice was necessary in order to get quality in education. We needed choice. Leading educators over 25 years ago said choice is needed. We must continue this choice option going forward. Please do not be persuaded to not do that. Choice is important. Now, at the time I was a student in high school, grade school and high school, segregation was the law of the land. And as a matter of fact, the United States Supreme Court justice spoke clearly that no person of color had any rights that a white person had to honor. That was said from our Supreme Court. Now, that same Supreme Court, in less than 55 years later, said that all people have a right to education. So we can change our attitudes. I suggest that we move forward on the questions of choice and not. The issue of segregation in housing is what drives segregation in schools, not schools. Schools don't create segregation. Housing patterns create segregation. In the metropolitan area, that is the case. So we must focus on what's driving this issue.
Thank you. Thank you for that invitation. And we, my apologies, because we just have very limited time, and I know I can see your faces, and I can see how you just really want to ask questions. And we really need to give the committee an opportunity to ask those questions. And so, members, here you have it. So this is the information. This is what is presented by our researchers, by our schools, by the people who interact with our students, with the programs, with teachers, with families who live in our neighborhoods. And they are presenting this information to us, and we have to make some decisions as to where do we go from here. So the main question I think that we need to respond to now is, I would like to invite you to help me figure out an answer to this question. So the question that we're being asked is whether or not we need to propose more legislation in order to address this issue of, you know, charter school growth, support, expansion, figuring out how we support the commissioner and the department on her effort to deal with authorizers and our teachers and our students. How do we go about it? Do we need more legislation, or do we simply need to monitor what is happening and make sure that we have mechanisms of monitoring that are not necessarily expansion of legislation? You have the information before you, and you have the people who were presenting, so let's ask the question. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Could you tell us who do you want to ask so that we can bring them up to the table?
Yeah, actually, I'd like to talk to the folks from the Charter School Partners. That's an organization dedicated to high-quality charters. Mm-hmm. And if they're in the room, I will. It's Brian Sweeney and Al Fan. That's an important group that I think will help us get to your answer.
And we will definitely have, you know, more people coming to present. Welcome to the committee. What is
your question, Senator Nelson?
Well, I'm going to ask them to just comment briefly on this issue of making sure we have high-quality charters. And while they're there, let me just say one thing, and then I'll reserve the rest of my comments for another time due to time constraints. Just further clarification, though, I want to make sure this committee knows that charter schools are subject to Minnesota's human rights language. That's in 124D.10 subdivision 8H. So I just want to make sure that that's a strict clarification, so there's no misunderstanding about that. Thank you very much.
Thank you,
Madam Chair.
Welcome, and if you could say a brief statement about what is your response to Senator Nelson.
Madam Chair, thank you, Senator.
Thank you for the opportunity to comment on the conversation today. Our organization, Charter School Partners, is very much focused on high-quality public education for all kids. And I think Mr. Nathan said it best when he said the conversation should not be about charters versus district schools. It should be about high-quality education. And we believe that part of the agreement that charter schools made when they became charters is to have be subject to a much greater level of accountability and oversight in exchange for the level of autonomy that they're receiving, the flexibility they have to operate their schools. So we believe that there are charter schools that are not performing as well as they should or as well as the contract they've signed stipulates they should. But we also believe that there are a number of charter schools that are, and we recognize the work that Ms. Baker-Smith is doing and Mr. Simmons. We believe that there should be exceptions to schools like those that serve a very high concentration of at-risk kids who are typically served by alternative learning centers. So we think there should be exceptions to the law, but we do believe that there should be a policy in place to strengthen our charter law that would hold authorizers and schools to a much higher level of accountability than is currently in place.
Thank you. And let me make sure, members, that how we frame, how others frame, and how media frames this conversation is up to them. The way I'm going to frame this is about making sure that our kids are served in our system. So if the frame is charters versus schools, whether charter, that's a different frame. The frame of this committee is about making sure that we have an effective system of education that serves every child in the state of Minnesota. That's our frame. So I hope that we're able to continue, you know, on that conversation, whether people want to talk about, you know, is this against this group. I think Senator Nelson and I made a commitment to each other that we're going to work together in a bipartisan way. We're not going to take sides about this group versus the other, this against the other idea, because our focus is going to be about kids, their success, their families, about teachers, and our success as a state of Minnesota in education. Any other questions, members? Questions that you have of the department or Mr. Orfield? Senator Carlson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a question for Mr. Orfield, and that is you went into the schools that had been closed and either stopped business for one reason or another. Do you have a log or a listing of all charter schools that have been closed and why, and what was the problems that caused them to be closed?
Mr. Orfield?
No. What we did to develop that chart is we just looked at the newspapers. We couldn't find a comprehensive listing from the department or any other place, but we looked at the newspapers and tried to follow up newspaper accounts and found a really high percentage of charters were closed either in relation to a misdemeanor or felony prosecution or mismanagement. And I think it would be a good thing to systematically look at. And one of the things that would be important to look at is the financial characteristics of the people that are running charter schools. Do they have bankruptcies or liens or things like this? I think in other states there's been a very consistent pattern of a certain percentage of charters where there's been misappropriation, where there's been improper use of public funds, and there's that. I think that's a big issue. Just to clarify, I wonder if I might, Madam Chair, about the civil rights law. The Minnesota exempts charters under Minnesota Rule 3535, which is the major administrative way that we deal with issues of integration and segregation. And it is exempted in a blank way. Now, it's generally under the human rights law, but the part of the law that regulates segregation and integration is Rule 3535, and I can't find another state that does anything like that. Most states say that charters are subject to the same rules as public schools. Many states, including South Carolina and North Carolina, say that charter schools can't interfere with an existing integration plan. Now, if a charter reflects its neighborhood and there's not an integration plan, there's nothing that stops a charter from being single race. But if a district like Eden Prairie or Apple Valley is trying to integrate their schools and up pops an all-white charter school that won't cooperate with them, I think that's a problem. That's what we were talking about.
Well, and we will get into more detail because clearly this is a question that probably we need to get, you know, together with the department to talk a little bit more about how that works and how in actual implementation of that type of regulation rule actually comes out. Senator Johnson.
I have a question for Mr. Nathan. You were around when the charter school legislation became law in Minnesota. And as I recall, the one reason why we accepted charter schools was because they were to provide us sort of an incubator for good ideas that would be passed on to the public schools that didn't have the rights that the charter schools had. And I'm wondering why has that not happened, or am I missing something?
Mr. Nathan.
Madam Chair, Senator, it's nice to see you, and thank you for the very important question. In the testimony, and I apologize for truncating it, but in the testimony I gave a number of examples of where that transfer has occurred. So briefly, and I should say that our three children attended St. Paul Public Schools. I'm going to talk briefly about St. Paul Public Schools, Minneapolis Schools, Forest Lake, Rochester, and a couple of other examples. One, parents in St. Paul Public Schools had the opportunity to go to Montessori District Public Schools. A number of parents asked for a Montessori middle school. The district did not respond. Therefore, a group of parents and teachers created a Montessori middle school. I'm delighted that the St. Paul schools, after this had been in operation and very successful for 5 or 6 years, decided to create a Montessori middle school. In Forest Lake, a group of parents who worked in St. Paul and Minneapolis and had opportunities to go to Montessori elementary schools as a part of the district in St. Paul and Minneapolis wanted to have a Montessori school in Forest Lake. Initially, the district said, no, we believe in equal educational opportunity. What they really meant was they believed in identical educational opportunity. But fortunately, there was a new school board elected, and they said, let's give this an option. And so they decided to create a Montessori elementary school in a wing of an elementary school building. In Rochester, a group of parents said, we've heard about really good core knowledge charter schools. We'd like to have a core knowledge elementary school in Rochester. The district said no, and the parents said, then we'll set up a charter. Then the district said, oh, we think we'll do that. And they brought in some people who worked in both district and core knowledge schools. I could actually go right around the state. Two other examples. Minnesota has received literally millions of dollars because Henderson, Minnesota, a group of rural parents and teachers, created a new model of public education in which the teachers, and I know you had extensive experience with public school teachers, and the teachers are the majority of members of the board of directors. It operates a lot like a law firm. It operates a lot like a medical practice, where it is the professionals, the teachers, who are in the majority of members of the board. Well, that idea has spread literally throughout the United States to both district and charters. And we have examples of the project-based approach. Mr. Simmons and his colleague, a former student of mine, represent one of those schools. But we have had project-based schools, both district and charter, that have been created in response to the success that the Minnesota New Country program has created. And I could give other examples. But my larger point is that I think there hasn't been nearly enough of this. We have, in our work, brought together district and charters, but this is one of the reasons that I'm recommending that the legislature formally charge and fund the Department of Education to bring together outstanding district and charters so that a lot more people can learn from these practices.
Thank you. I would like to ask the department to join us for a moment. I do have a question. I think the question for me now is, members, whether or not we, after asking the department to work with the authorizer to kind of put a system in place to do, to kind of gather the information, conduct the evaluation, give us some results. My question to you is, do you feel that we have what it takes in terms of direction, legislative direction, in order to accomplish what we are set out to accomplish, which is to gather this information, give us the information that we need about what is working, what is not working? If I see in your presentation And what is this, the seventh page? I asked for a larger print because I couldn't follow the little print that you sent us. You have a part of your presentation called Rewards and Consequences of Evaluation Report. And in there, you offer kind of this sequence of events and decisions that need to be made in order to arrive to kind of the place where you have a clear understanding after they submit the information about the action steps that you need to take. That's kind of how I read that. You know, you have an understanding of how to collect that information, how to analyze that information, and then how to take some action on that. I believe that you really are the only ones who can keep track of this in an ongoing basis and just give us the information that the public needs in order to kind of make the correct decisions. Could you tell me if you feel like over time we are headed in a direction where we will know more, we will have in-depth information, and we will be proud to say that we've made the right decisions about supporting and expanding models at work, and basically dealing with the systems or practices or even schools that are not working? I don't know if that's too loaded of a question, but I do feel that that's kind of the core question behind our effort to learn what's going on right now.
All right. Madam Chair, members, again, Kevin McHenry, Assistant Commissioner at the Department of Education. I appreciate that question. I wish I could give you a simple one-word answer, yes or no. I don't think we're there just yet. I do want to say a couple things, maybe put a little nuance to that. First, in reference to kind of the rewards and consequences of the evaluation system, I just want to make sure it's clear to everybody that we're in the middle of developing this. We are getting as much input as possible to try to put together a transparent, fair, accountable system that authorizers will feel that they can use, and that charter schools will see that as a useful tool as well. We think this is a great step in the direction of evolving the charter school law. That's something that we really need to do here in Minnesota. Going back to the question, or one thing that we also feel that's very important, going back to the question from Senator Johnson, I think one of the things that we feel that's really important is that we do need to make sure that we are identifying these high-quality charter schools, but actually providing ways for them to replicate those practices, not with just other charter schools, but with other schools in general. I think that is something that we feel has been the mission of the charter school movement here in Minnesota. And although there have been some, Mr. Nathan alluded to some ideas that could have happened, I think that we do need to have something in process that we can be a little bit more helpful to the charter schools that are providing or that have these best practices, but also to the authorizers so they can work with their charter schools, work with their entire portfolio, and disseminate the best practices as widely as possible. As far as needing more legislation, that's something that we're really careful about. We want to make sure that the legislation that was passed in 2009 and that has evolved into now, that we want to make sure that that's working as well as it should. Obviously, there are always ways that we need to clean up some legislation. I don't know, everybody, there are different ideas that can be brought forward and we can discuss those. But I think what we feel as a department really comfortable with right now is that with the development of this authorizer evaluation system, we're really putting something out there for our authorizers who are overseeing our charter schools to be effective and to hold those charter schools accountable. And then at the same time, we want to be very careful that that we're building this in a way so we don't have a one-size-fits-all method. I mean, I think you did hear some testimony here that obviously there's different ways of how different charter schools can operate, and that's, I think, something that we want to make sure we keep an eye on. But at the same time, we want to make sure that we do have high standards. We are holding our charter schools accountable. And I think through this evaluation system, that's our big first step. And then I think also through our high-quality charter school grant, I think that's our next step as far as replication. And those are the two areas where we want to see some significant improvement.
Ms. Murphy, do you have enough resources to get the work done?
Well, Yeah, loaded question. Madam Chair, committee members, thank you again. So well, I will defer to Mr. McHenry to address questions about specific resources. I did want to add on to the point of, you know, charters are as diverse. I mean, there's no such thing as just one true charter and everything looks the same. And so one of our struggles as well as opportunities is to create an authorizer evaluation system that accounts for differences as well as respects models that may not easily be rolled up into three data points that are available for all schools in the state. And so as we have been engaging with authorizers, we've received feedback from authorizers, many of whom are in the room, you know, that said, hey, you know, we understand the need to use state performance data, but we also want to have an opportunity to share data about our unique portfolio of schools and some other kind of performance points that we use to evaluate the quality of the school. And so we are very much cognizant of that. And the authorizer annual report, which was established in law that we will begin receiving in the fall, will be a primary conduit by which the authorizers are able to report additional data, performance data, success data about their portfolio of schools, which may not be captured by the state data that we already have.
How many people work in your division providing that kind of support?
So currently, I have we have a full-time charter center coordinator who largely works with the federal grant project, and then we have two charter center specialists. One position was filled in December, and then a second position, which has been vacant, will be filled at the end of the month. And in addition, we have an administrative assistant position, which is also currently being filled. We are a small team.
Yeah. You typically are very small teams to do a lot of work. Senator, you had a question, Senator Claus.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Is Mr. Smith still here?
Simmons.
I'm sorry, Mr. Wilson.
Yep, behind you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. I grew up during that time of desegregation, but I attended a much different situation than you. In suburban Minnesota here, I graduated with 1,000 white students. I think we had zero black students in my class. I think we had two Asian students in the class. One of them was a foreign exchange student. Mm-hmm. The question, having lived during those 60s, do you have concerns about what's happening with segregation? What's taking place, not only in the inner city, but as we saw out in our second ring suburbs, where we're having charter schools all white, and we're having a lot of charter schools inner city that are all students of color?
So, Madam Chair, Senator, I'm certainly concerned that all children get, first and foremost, a quality education. Without that, they are subject to a second-class lifestyle. And part of what reminds me of that or informs me of that is a report done by the Brookings Institute in this region that says in a very short time, over 80% of all jobs that will be created in this region will require at least 2 years of college. And I think of students who aren't getting anywhere near a quality of education that would allow them to participate in this new economy. I think education, at the end of the day, is going to trump the segregation question. And as I said, the segregation is primarily driven by housing patterns, not school patterns. I think this is a short-term issue with a predominantly schools of one ethnic group or another. I think that, too, will pass. I think there's a whole movement in state law that's going to address that. I think the authorized policies being developed by the department is going to address that. But opportunity at the end of the day is going to address that, because people are seeking change and innovation, and schools that can do that will survive, and schools that can't will not. It's something that will change in time. I think, finally, that young people are finding their way to connect with each other far beyond opportunities that you and I had. And it's not necessarily in the classroom. It's some advocates advocate for who sits next to whom, and I advocate for what are they going to take from the learning experience.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Wilson. Well, we've been told that in about a minute we're not going to have a recording system, so I apologize, but we have to end this, and it's required that we tape our meeting. So thank you for attending. People in the audience are happy to interact with you if you have more time. Thank you, members. Thank
you. Good reading there.
I saw the tweets on this one.
Yes, sir, in my file, yeah.
Absolutely.